Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 3rd, 2001. In the Koinonia Fireside Room this evening is Janet Moline. Today's session number is MOJ-2001-02, and it's titled Old Growth Forests of the Pacific Northwest, a Threatened Ecosystem. Let's listen in.
Well, it's 6:20, so I'm going to start so we can because we have chapel to go to, and I think this will take the full hour. My name is Janet Moline, and so tapers can start taping. I am an environmental science teacher from Illinois. So I know you're saying, what is she talking about the Pacific Northwest for? And I'm sure there are some of you here that know far more than I do. However, in the course, what I take, we take different biomes of the world. It's for juniors and seniors. And we cover the tundra and the taiga, of which this would be a part. Because of mountains, we're too far south to be in the taiga. So when you have these taiga characteristics, another name for the taiga is the northern coniferous forest. So a lot of what I'm saying here is going to apply to Canada and to probably Vancouver. And it on the map, the biome map, it sort of comes down into Washington and Oregon because of your mountains. So at the top of the mountains, for example, for my students in Illinois, the closest way for them to see the coniferous forest is to go to the Rocky Mountains. Tundra is going to be at the top, and then you're going to get the coniferous trees and then the deciduous trees, because I'm in a deciduous tree state on the edge of the prairie. So what I've put in here is I just put some characteristics of this biome, because in a couple of nights I'm help yourself to
okay,
in a couple of nights I'm going to be doing my last one of the series. I did wolves a couple of days ago, and then drilling for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is the third one, and then I will have a handout on tundra characteristics. So these are the taiga characteristics as one goes to the north. So you can just read through this. It certainly doesn't have the biodiversity, say, as the tropical rainforest does. But this particular, the old growth forest of the Pacific Northwest has a tremendous amount of biodiversity in a biome that basically doesn't have a lot of biodiversity around the world. You know, when you think of the world, and we never see the world this way, if you look at the world from the North Pole, from the top view, you will see that this is a biome that goes all the way around the world, and you have lynx in Asia, and you have lynx in North America. You have spruce there, you have spruce there. It was one continuous band at one time. But what you have special out here is that you have a temperate rainforest, and I don't need to tell you that, but I might have some guests, some people here from other states. You know, you say in the United States, true or false, we have rainforest in the United States. And of course, my students will say, no, we don't. Well, of course, we do have tropical rainforest, don't we? What state?
Hawaii.
Tropical rainforest in Hawaii, but temperate rainforest in California, Oregon, Washington, and Alaska. Okay, and it is truly a treasure. It's truly a treasure. And you don't have much of it left. Now, we were just at the Weyerhaeuser corporate office before we came here in Tacoma, and they talk about that Weyerhaeuser, and I know I'm mispronouncing it to you, but Frederick Weyerhaeuser, which was how the family pronounced the name, was a Rock Island, Illinois person. Okay, his family came from Germany. But together with Frederick Denkman, who was his brother-in-law, they set up a sawmill, and they were very smart. They borrowed money, and they bought timberlands up in Wisconsin and Minnesota. And they cut down the old growth in the 1800s. And if you look on that one sheet that I have there, it tells you about a third of the way down, about the timber industry and how it moved west, how it started in Maine. And then eventually it says the Great Lakes states by the 1880s. And that's truly when Weyerhaeuser, which was how the name, they now pronounce it Weyerhaeuser here. But the family, their mansion is in Rock Island. It is part of Augustana College. The house on the hill was the Weyerhaeuser mansion that's part of our campus. But when you go to Weyerhaeuser now, there's no mention that they took all the trees in the Midwest before they, and then they went to Minneapolis, and then they cut down those trees, and then they ended up, now I am not knocking Weyerhaeuser as a company, because I think they own a lot of land, and they do a very good job. But I think what we want to, what I want to make the distinction of, and then we're going to watch a part of a video on this, is that I want to make a distinction between trees and old growth, okay? Because it's not the same thing. I'm using paper. I have used today paper towels. I have used toilet paper. I have written on paper in a journal. I have read a book today. I have read part of a magazine. I have used paper today. So we're not saying not to cut down. The question is, the remaining old growth that you have in the Pacific Northwest that is truly a treasure, that people like me come from Illinois and say, wow, I wonder how big the trees used to be in Wisconsin and Minnesota. Okay, because for us, they've only had 100 years to grow back. You have 800-year-old trees, you know, and that's the argument. Well, they grow back, but you know what? I don't have 800 years to wait, you know, to see them. And I come out here and I go, wow, these are so great, you know, what a treasure. So we'll start out, I don't know if any of you have seen the video, Rage Over Trees. It was produced by the Audubon Society. It's from the PBS series, and it was produced in 1990, and it takes place in Opal Creek. Now, for those of you who are from Oregon, you know where Opal Creek is. It's in the Willamette National Forest, the Detroit District, near the northern part of, not too awfully far east of Portland. For those of you, and Opal Creek was the last low-level watershed, okay, the last low-level watershed in Oregon with old growth, all right, and it was scheduled to be logged. Okay, now keep in mind as you're watching this that national forests are a part of what department?
Interior.
Not the interior. Agriculture. Okay, agriculture. Now that's a different story. Whether or not you see a tree as part of a forest or whether or not you see it as part of a tree farm. So we have national forests that are really national farms. Okay, and that's the difference. That is a little bit different. So let's start out, and we won't watch this whole video, but I want you to get an idea, especially if you're not from Oregon and you haven't been to the Olympic rainforest and seen these fantastic trees, to get some idea. And we do need to take the little lid off of that. So we'll just grab that lid off.
Press the button.
Okay, so this is the same thing.
My name is Paul Newman. When settlers first came to North America, ancient forests covered much of the continent. Our forefathers cut and burned trees to clear the land. Then came the loggers who cut and moved out. Today, only 2% of the original ancient forests are left. Most of these forests are in the Pacific Northwest. There are almost 2 square miles of trees are cut down each week. Will the remaining ancient forests continue to be cut, or should they be protected? That is the question.
This Audubon special is made possible by the
in accordance with man's laws too. But I'm also listening to God's laws right now, and we're raping here, and it's not right.
You're sick. You're all sick. Now you know what I'm wanting? You live in a whole home made out of wood. Your paychecks are printed on paper, Pope. And now you're down here protesting a man making a living.
A family outraged by logging near their home. Take the law into their own hands.
I'm cutting dying trees. You know why they're dying? The U.S. Forestry guy said to me, the reason why they're dying. You be quiet, listen to me. You be quiet.
But the confrontation over ancient trees reaches far beyond this Oregon family. The conflict over whether we are going to cut these forests or save the future generations reaches to the heart of our society's values. The battle comes into focus in this pristine valley, Oatman Creek watershed in Oregon, is only 8 miles long and 3 miles wide. The valley is filled with ancient, old-growth trees up to 800 years old and 200 feet high. Forest Service scientists have identified Oatman Creek as the last low-elevation, uncut watershed in Oregon and asked for its preservation. But Forest Service administrators want to sell the timber. This valley is part of a national forest, but two men have very different plans for its future. Rob Ferris, vice president of Ferris Lumber Company, wants to log Oatman Creek and is worried about the Forest Service proposals to reduce record high-level timber sales in Oregon.
Oregon doesn't have the ability to diversify to such a great degree in such short order that we will not cause a catastrophic economic effect.
George Atiyah spent much of his youth in Oatman Creek Valley, and for three generations his family has fought to keep the loggers out. Atiyah would like to see the valley saved as a state or national park.
Industry says we got to keep cutting these trees down because we got to preserve jobs and support our economy in the state of Oregon. But what everybody's got to realize is we're out of these guys, and whether we quit cutting them now and leave a few of them left or wait 5 more years until, or 10 more years until they're all gone, party's over.
The battle in the Pacific Northwest is part of the struggle that is, in fact, nationwide. There are 156 national forests. As plans are made for the future of these forests, conservationists and the timber industry battle over how much forest to cut and how much to protect. Nowhere are there stronger differences of opinion than in the Willamette National Forest and Oatman Creek. In Oregon, industry practice calls for clear-cutting thousands of acres at the same time. Private owners have cut nearly all the ancient forests on their land. The U.S. Forest Service sells national forest timber in swatches of 10 to 60 acres. To access the timber, the Forest Service has already built or permitted enough logging roads to reach the moon and planned for 100,000 miles more. Cutting these valleys helps mill owners like Rob Ferris prosper, and many towns have grown up around mills. People in these towns depend on the mills for jobs. Besides, county governments get up to one half of the proceeds of federal forest sales to spend on schools and roads. On the other hand, tourism is one of Oregon's largest industries. Natural beauty is the attraction. But as clear cuts degrade the view around popular resort areas, threatening wildlife and watershed, more and more citizens like Atiyah are protesting. Jim Monteith, who was born in Oregon, has made saving ancient forests, which are called old growth, his life work. He is executive director of the Oregon Natural Resources Council.
I grew up in southern Oregon in an area that was full of bald eagles and big trees and all the things that I thought everybody grew up with. When it came time to go to college, I went far away. I went to the East Coast to see what that was like, and It was only then I realized what it was that I had grown up with and how rare and how unique it is.
Monteith began studying fishes, a fur-bearing animal dependent on old growth, but found long-term studies were impossible because the forests and fishers were disappearing faster than he could study.
I was outraged realizing that I couldn't even be a scientist, and I then went to work for a conservation organization. And I realize now that the decisions that we make in the next year or so are going to dictate whether or not we're going to have any of these cathedral forests left in 5 or 10 years. The decision is now.
As Monteith travels around Oregon, he finds that some people applaud his campaign, some people can scarcely tolerate it. People in the timber industry think the policies he proposes would ruin the economy of Oregon. Following Monteith around Oregon, watching people's strong reactions to him, pro and con, is a direct way of appreciating the feelings of Oregonians about their ancient forest. When Monteith visits Ferris Mill, he gets a direct exposure to the industry point of view. Ferris's company owns no forests. His mills are completely dependent on timber from public land.
It's going to be here forever, and it's going to be a supply that
will. Always have.
Forever?
Forever.
It's hard to believe that trees this big will be here forever. Maybe if we grow them to be that big, but we're growing them to be smaller. What will you do if you get to that point where you can't have a tree size?
Well, they don't grow smaller, they grow bigger.
Dr. Jerry Franklin is a Forest Service scientist and a University of Washington professor. He has been studying old growth for 20 years and is the foremost U.S. authority on ancient forests.
There are some people who are totally utilitarian, you know, and if they aren't putting it to use in some very practical, human-directed way, they aren't happy with it.
The impression that one gets is that we have plenty of them and they're everywhere and there's no issue, there's no problem. And that's part of the problem we're having is making clear that old, sure, per se is a very limited resource.
It is interesting that the rate of timber cuttings going on here in Oregon, Washington, actually exceeds the percentage in terms of the rate of cutover that's going on in the tropical regions. And so, you know, we hear all the time about the rate of deforestation of the tropical forest, and it's tremendous. And it's a catastrophe. But we have a much higher rate of forest cutting going on here in the Pacific Northwest. So all you got to do is fly over the landscape and you have a real appreciation of how rapidly we're cutting it over. So Brazil has nothing on the Northwest.
Opal Creek flows out of the lake only 3,500 feet in elevation, which makes the valley particularly valuable. There are no other low elevation, largely intact watersheds in Oregon. In its lower reaches, Opal Creek provides local residents with a spectacular swimming hole.
Here's the outline. I think this is the last one. I mean, this only valley, that's the only good.
George Achia manages a small silver mine halfway up the valley. He grew up with a wilderness for inspiration and playground.
It's really not too much for a kid to get trouble doing up there, so I took off one day with my fly pole and started hiking up Opal Creek and just to discover it. And I got up there and I just was just awed, even at 11 years old, by the beauty of the place, the size of the trees, and the whole thing. I was just radiant, I guess, when I got back to the camp telling everybody what I discovered. And then they told me that the Forest Service was planning on logging it. And I made up my mind then that I wasn't going to let it happen. And I was told that there was nothing I could do about it.
At the age of 12?
At the age of 12.
You spent 20 years now?
20 years trying to keep them from logging Opal Creek. If enough people see that they're going to lose, then the Forest Service will never be able to cut it.
An ancient forest is nature's unique creation, a special world, where people like Atiyah feel a sense of almost sacred awe. Huge ancient trees rise 20 stories high.
Up here, and we've done it ever since.
my granddaughter will be a senior in college next year, so you know how important a place this is to us. I also have in my will that my ashes be sprinkled in the Opal Pool. They're trying to log the old growth in this greenage, and it really needs protection. And this is one place where I could lay down in front of a logging truck and feel okay. I don't approve of that sort of activism usually, but for this place I could.
As part of his campaign to save Open Creek Valley, George Atiyah encourages visitors from all over the country.
Actually, the one behind us is both the Woods Roadless area, and then this is Open Creek Roadless area. They want to build a road, a mid-slope road, around and then harvest that over on that side.
You know, I won't object to that word harvest. Harvest implies you nurture something and care for it, and then you try to do it back. This is mining. You mine a forest like this.
That's
and
right.
Comes back.
That's exactly
what they're going to come back 6 feet thick and 300 feet high. And that's not harvesting.
That's right.
That's an industry public relations term they devised 20 years ago to make it sound better because they're ashamed of what they're doing.
When I tell people back east, you know, they're cutting on your public forest trees 6 feet thick and 200 feet high, and they're down to the last one. They can't believe it.
I've seen people come from back east and they don't believe, they didn't even know that they cut the national forest. They thought they were national parks or like that. To me, it's like somebody who got an inheritance and they went out and had a big party with it and blew it all at once. And then they went there at the end and they don't have anything left. They go, gee whiz, where'd it go? What happened?
The two principles I feel are very important for land steward. First of all, that you don't reduce the capacity of the land to produce. You don't reduce its long-term productivity. You don't mine it. The second ethic is that you don't extirpate species. At least you don't knowingly and willfully eliminate species in our ecosystems. And I think, you know, the old growth issue is strongly related to both those ethical principles.
Researchers have found 160 species closely associated with old growth. The northern spotted owl and threats to its survival had become a central issue in the fight over ancient forests. In 1973, Eric Forsman, then a graduate student, discovered that the northern spotted owl needs old growth forests to survive. Forsman is now a Forest Service biologist. Harriet Allen studies the owl for Washington State's Department of Wildlife.
Because we don't know very much about a lot of the species that occur in the forests out here in terms of their ecology or the effects of timber harvest upon them. Spotted owl is often used as an indicator species.
It's our barometer, an indicator of the health of the ecosystem, like the canary in the coal mine. When things go wrong for the canary, it's an indication that things are wrong for being in the coal mine. It will give us an indication of what may be happening to other species that live in old growth forest ecosystem.
Decisions that are made today as far as how much old growth is left is going to determine the fate of these species and whether it does indeed survive.
Forsman and Allen's research has shown that each pair of owls requires up to 3 square miles of ancient forest to survive. Conservationists have held up timber sales by suing the Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management to set aside forests for the owl's protection. Often, forestmen can locate the owls with a whistle.
Watch where he flies to with the mouse down. Like right now, you could hear him whistling up the slope there. He's calling for the female to see where she's at. We just follow him and see where he goes, then usually they'll take us right to the young.
Okay, we need to keep our eyes open as we walk up the hill here, because we may be able to spot them even before we hear them if they don't call. Just kind of keep your eyes open.
There's one up there.
Pick out which one of them's got the hands on. These guys are probably not very hungry, otherwise, if they're hungry, they usually start to beg. Kind of a high-pitched rasping sound up there. He just sort of acts like he doesn't really care. Like big, she'd probably take the mouse right to him, but they're not acting hungry, so she's just kind of sitting up there wondering if she needs to feed him or not.
There we go.
Forrest went out and banned the young owls to follow their move.
The popping sound you hear is the beak. If you snap the beak, it's a threat. When they're frightened or angry, they pop their beak at you. It's supposed to scare you.
In the past, species that have gone extinct to a large extent have been due to man's ignorance. But in this case, it will be deliberate decision making.
I don't really blame so much the decision makers and politicians, because in a democratic society, basically they are responding to the will of the people. And from my perspective, in situations like this, where there's a constant increasing demand for lumber, for resources from everyone. Basically, we're all the problem, and the enemy is us.
Maybe the decisions that are being made by some politicians are from a small portion of the public, that the vast majority of the public has not been participating in the decision-making on this issue because they're not aware of it. And hopefully, they will become aware of it and have more participation.
Definitely true. Whoever makes the loudest noise is... Whichever groups make the loudest noises, they're the ones who the politicians and administrators respond to, so.
Giant trees is controversial even within the timber industry. In 1988, a large timber company, which owned their own forest, shipped them. cut in the northwest, primarily to Korea, China, and Japan. Smaller mill owners say that these exports are wrong, and that shipping raw logs abroad destroys mill jobs and can boost employment at home. In the Northwest, unmilled logs shipped abroad in 1988 represent a loss of up to 16,000 possible jobs. The United States is the only country in the world which permits massive export of raw logs. Congress not only permits these sales, but has refused to permit Oregon or other states to limit. Timber companies are cutting more trees than ever. Nonetheless, as companies invest in ever more sophisticated machines, employment in the timber industry keeps going down. Automation costs jobs. Log export costs jobs. Setting aside forest land costs jobs. Workers who can't control the rate of automation or log export see no way out except to keep on cutting ancient forests as long as they last.
My grandfather, my father, and I all work in the timber industry. I like the job, I like the work, I like to cut trees. But I don't think that all the old growth ought to be cut. But the amount that should be saved is a plenty of argument. Trees is the only thing that you can plant and is going to grow back. You use the coal out of the ground, it's going to take a long time for it to grow back. You use oil, it don't grow back very fast. And trees is the only thing that if you cut one down and you plant two more, you've got an 80% chance of one of those getting big enough to cut it down again in 80 years. And if we stop the project just so we can sit and look at the trees,
Bob Zeke is an old-time logger. Now he feels very differently about the part he once played in cutting down the big trees. The stumps here are the remains of an ancient forest, and the second growth timber on this land has also been cut.
I would have liked to walk through this area when it was a virgin forest. I never saw these trees. They were cut at about the time I was born. When I was 18, that's when they would allow a young man to be involved in the logging because of the danger. I stayed in there all of these years up until 1974 when I retired. I'm aware of the loggers' life, the sweat, the cold, freezing weather that you're in, the kind of pay that they get, the dangers they're subjected to, and most of them getting crippled up one way or the other. The falling of the trees is something that you don't forget. With the handsaws, as you went into the woods, it was quiet, excepting for the silky swish, 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 swish of the saw as it worked through the tree. When the tree was about to fall, there was a call of timber, and this is what I heard. Timber, there she goes, there she goes, down the hill, timber, and then this huge tree popping as the wood broke, would reluctantly begin to leave the stump and be on its way. This county doesn't have a single square mile of what used to be. We let it all go. I'm very much ashamed now to think that there wasn't someone around with brains enough to say, hold it, hold it, hold it. What are we going to show the people of tomorrow, the children, your children, and so on? These timberlands belong to the American people. So we can't allow any particular group say we're going to manage or handle this timber for our particular benefit. It's not for the loggers or the timber companies to choose or to make that decision.
Can conservationists and timbermen find a middle ground? The question arises.
Can they find the middle ground? All right. Well, what did you think? Pretty good video. I know you didn't come here to watch videos, but I really think that I could have given you all those same arguments, and it really sort of captured what those old growth. Now, what happened to Opal Creek? Do we have people here from Oregon? Was it saved?
Yes, it was.
Yes, it was saved. It was saved. Okay. The whole idea of the old growth forest is an incredible coming together when you saw, well, first of all, you saw all those roads going through the log, you know, the logged area. We lose so much money. We have lost billions of dollars. Every year we lose money on the national forest. If you were a business, you would have gone bankrupt. So who pays the loss? We do. Taxpayers do. Now, I normally don't complain about paying taxes, but I surely mind paying taxes for, I know the post office loses money, but you know what? We need to have our mail, okay? But when you lose money on national forests, you have to wonder, when they talk about jobs, all that money could be used to retrain people. Will people be lost in small towns? Yes. Of course there's going to be people that are going to be lost in small towns. But don't forget, every time, what is the super? Walmart. You talk about lost jobs across the country. Let's talk about Walmart and all the jobs that have been lost to Walmart. So the incredible, and it's on this sheet here, this information about, I wanted to do just a little brief eco in the time we have left, and then I can have any comments here that you would have. In the second paragraph, does anybody need a copy of this if you don't have one? This is what I give to my students. A handout, and the questions that are in the back, that's what they are supposed to fill out, so I'm not wanting to treat you like your juniors in high school or whatever, but I have them read this and answer the questions on the back, and so for purposes of coming out here, I merely took things out of the file, and I know you'll understand that. But the reason when you cut down these old growth forests, why they can't grow back very easily and why forests can't grow back very easily is that there's a little critter called the red-backed vole. The red-backed vole. And voles live underground. All right. Now, what they eat are they eat truffles. And what are truffles? Truffles are the reproductive form of the fungi, a fungus. Now, when you think of fungus being bad, but in the forest, fungus is really good. Now, if you have gone on some of these trails here and you see that trees have fallen down, do you notice how shallow their roots are? On the big trees, wouldn't you think their roots would go down like corn? I mean, corn roots go down farther than these tree roots. So these trees literally have very shallow roots. But look at all the huge needles that they have to get water for. So how do you get more needles and nutrients? You have a special relationship with fungus. So as fungus goes out into the soil and into leaves, and digesting leaves, the fungus, which have no chlorophyll and can't make their own food, but they can take in, they can dissolve minerals in water, and they can bring those, that water and minerals, into the tree. Tree says, thank you. Have some sap. Have some sugar. I've made it. I've got it. You get me the water, I'll get you the sugar. Great relationship. It's going on under the ground. Under the ground. We don't even know. Because we think fungus, oh, fungus, oh. You know, that's like athlete's foot. You know, bad stuff. No. They think of, they go out literally. They're going out as much as they can to get water back to the trees. Well, the fungus has to get spread, and so it has an incredible way of getting spread. It produces truffles, which are very tasty to redback voles. So the redback voles, they eat the fungus, they eat the truffles, and they go through the forest, and they defecate. Now they have spread the spores some other place. All right? Now I'm going to cut down that tree. Gone. What's going to happen to the roots? Die. Any need for fungus anymore? No need for fungus anymore. Any need for the redback vole anymore? No need for the redback vole anymore. As a matter of fact, as it tries to go to some other place now in the clear cut, we've got owls that can pick off those redback voles. So now we plant, we say, okay, we're gonna plant new trees. So now we plant a new tree there. But do we plant the fungus? Can we even have redback voles when trees are this high? No, because they're clearly visible to the predators. So now we have no redback voles, we have no, and then we don't understand why the second growth trees don't grow very good. And they have to be artificially fertilized. Because you see, nature had them fertilized by the fungus and the redback vole, and now humans are involved, and we just see it as a tree, and so, okay, now they're not growing as well, so I guess now we will add fertilizer to them. And now we don't have a forest anymore, do we? We have a farm, and we're managing a farm. And we'll cut down those trees in 80 years, and then we'll start all over again, and we'll plant them again, and they'll all be the same kind. So what you have out here in the old growth, and if 98% of the old growth has been removed from the United States, and you only have 2% left, and you have them to protect them. In that 2% that are left, they're certainly worth saving. They're worth saving. I mean, if you can't make enough paper and houses and products out of 98% of the land that was old growth, that in the Midwest we are never going to have again, then you haven't done your management of your forest very well. We have a lot of timber. We might as well use our stuff in the Midwest because we're not going to get old growth again. Might as well cut our trees over and over and over and over again. A couple of things before I leave you here and allow you to ask some questions, actually. If you're interested in anything at Opal Creek, okay, and you haven't gone there because we are going to Opal Creek. I have taught about this. I have shown this video. It is 10 years old. And I emailed the Detroit District of the Willamette National Forest, and I said, is there a better video on Pacific old growth? And they said, no, this is the best one. And I said, because I don't like showing videos in school that are 10 years old. But this is absolutely the best one. And they said, oh, by the way, because they leave at the end of it, which we didn't get to, says, they said it's going to be logged. Okay, and so now, of course, you know it wasn't logged. But if you go to www.opalcreek.org, you can get all sorts of information on old growth forests and the Friends of Opal Creek and the trails and maps and hiking things and all sorts of things to do, which we are going to do after we leave home. Okay, I'm so excited. I have taught something for 10 years and I'm finally going to get to see it, other than the video, which if any of you want to see this video again. The other thing that's really a good article is in September, October 2000 of the Sierra magazine. And this is an excellent article called Big Timber's Big Lies. and it talks about the jobs, which it tells you if you've lost $1 billion and you divide the loggers retraining, that's $30,000 a piece to retrain every lost job. And then you still haven't, you've kept your trees and you've never retrained people to do something else. The whole argument when they talk about, well, you have to, what about forest fires? Forest fires will go through old growth. Actually, there are more fires in forest land that has been cut, because the current way of cutting now is that they take the tree, after they cut the tree, they have the debrancher that goes and they leave all that dead fall on the ground. So what do you think burns more? There are actually more fires that are hotter and worse in a replanted area than you would get in old growth. Okay, and the argument that they give here on schools, they actually tried to pass a law in Congress that would take the funding of schools in the Northwest not related to timber sales. It didn't pass in Congress. Guess why? Timber money. Timber money didn't want, they wanted the schools to be related to timber sales because they would lose their leverage with the public. If schools were paid for by the federal government and weren't dependent on timber sales, what are they going to do about their timber sales? So they fought it. They lobbied hard in Congress not to get that passed. So in any case, what I have my students do, which we don't have time to do here, is to go through and say the difference between a tree farm and a forest. And this is the list that my students come up with. On a tree farm, humans plant tree and nature does the planting. Tree farm, people add fertilizer. Decaying plants and animals add fertilizer. Trees are to be cut down. Trees fall down by wind, ice, lightning. Walk in rows in a tree farm, walk on trails. Fewer kinds of animals, wide variety of animals. Same age trees, different age trees. No beaver dams, beaver dams. Same kinds of trees, many kinds of trees. Trees protected to keep animals away. No tree protectors. Irrigate if needed, snow and rain. Too much, too little shade, right amount of shade. Because at the beginning, when they're first coming up, there's too much sun. And then when afterwards, then they're all the same age all together. Kill weeds, okay? Don't kill weeds, because in the forest, there are no weeds. No protesters to save trees. Okay, protesters to save. Will eventually be cut. Let get older. Put out fires. Let fires burn. Remove deadfall and snags. Leave the dead wood and snags. Little medicinal value. Much medicinal value. Little tourism. Lots of tourism. Okay, so... So, any comments? It's time for, it's quarter after, our time is up. Comments, yes?
I've been to Opal Creek, I've hiked in there a number of times. It's a gorgeous area. The Oregon Natural Resources Council fought very valiantly to save that area. It wasn't an easy hike at all.
No, and people can check that out too on www.opalcreek. And find out about that battle. Yes.
You teach a high school class, is it?
I do.
High school ecology or what?
Global biology. For those of you that were here when I did wolves, when I was a high school biology teacher, I found that the chapters I liked most were all at the end of the book on the environment, and you never got there because you were so busy learning about mitochondria and DNA and stuff that, you know, DNA extraction and, you know, two X's and Y's equal X, Y, and all blah, 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 blah. And I just thought, oh, all the fun is at the end. So I went to my administrators and said, can I just set up an upper level course just that does the last part of the book? And that's what I do. It's a year course. So I have about 160 students a year take it.
Wow.
Juniors and seniors only. I limit it to juniors and seniors. They always want to put in sophomores, but I always want to have it be, I want kids to be able to drive. Because once they drive, they have cars. And once they have cars, they're paying for gasoline. And every decision in the environment, every decision is based on economics. There's always an economic component. You save Opal Creek, Does that mean jobs? Does that mean this? Does that mean that? And I want my kids to be able to drive and to be able to know the value of economics. You know, would they want to be a logger? And once they have to start getting money and mom and dad aren't just giving them cash, they well, the environment and the economy are together. So, any other comments? Sorry, I didn't give you much chance to, yes, look.
Bush has been really doing a lot of things to the environment that are a real concern. Do you anticipate some resurgence of issues around places like this?
Well, I don't want to step on anybody's toes politically here, but the best thing that could happen, of course, was that the Senate went Democrat. It's like, you know, yes, there is a God. You know, after the election, you're saying, God, how could you do this to me? For 10 years I've been doing this. You can't do this to me. Okay, and then we came up with the Democratic Senate, and I'm going, thank you, yes. Okay, I mean, that is a religious experience. So he's already pulled off the drill Arctic drilling. He did, however, has tabled the snowmobiling to allow snowmobiling in national parks. Norm Till, what were the statistics on that?
Well, both with that one and with this issue, the argument's been used that they need to have more study and more hearings. And when Clinton and Gore were out here in 1992 and 1994 to try and work out that compromise and instruct the Forest Service to have hearings, they had hearings for about 3 years, and I don't remember the exact figure, but it's something like 50 to 70,000 comments, letters that were received in the hearing process. And then the Clinton administration on the old growth came up with that compromise, as some of you may know, that irritated both the environmentalists. I mean, I happen to have thought it was a good compromise, but a good compromise. The lumbering people didn't like it because it was too strict, and the conservationists didn't like it because it was still letting the timber industry. And so then that was pulled back a little bit because they're looking at it again because they're saying it didn't have enough of a hearing process. And then I just read in the New York Times here four days ago, that the same argument now is being used in the Yellowstone. So the ban on snowmobiles in Yellowstone, which had been put in after, again, 2 years of study with 71,000 letters coming in the hearing process, the senior fellow now in the Interior Department has said, we're going to pull back that proposed regulation change because we need to have more input into the process.
All I can say is 4 more years. And hopefully, I mean, all that other stuff when we had a Republican, I'm sorry if you're Republican, I really am. If when you had a Republican Congress and the whole Congress was Republican, you always knew that Clinton was going to veto everything. You knew it was never going to get by because he was going to veto it. And he did. He vetoed practice after practice after practice after practice. Probably Opal Creek might not even have been, it probably would have been logged had not Clinton been president. And really knowing that things at the top, that there was hope. After the last election, there really was no hope, except now there is hope again. So time for chapel, time to praise the Lord, time to praise Old Growth. And